Right, thank you, David. John, it is a favourite book for many people. It's different, isn't it? It's not like the other Gospels. And there are so many great quotes in John, aren't there? And I hope that tonight we'll get a better idea of what John was getting at and why he said these things, and to put some of those quotes in a better context so we understand a bit more about what we're saying. Let's start at the beginning. Who was John? Well, he was John the Apostle, John the Disciple. Almost everyone agrees on that, which is unusual. And we know that he was especially close to Jesus. And it's believed that he and his brother James were probably cousins of Jesus. He refers to himself as the disciple that Jesus loved. And the thing about the Gospel is he never mentions himself. And so you have to know that that's what he's referring to. It's most likely he started out as a disciple of John the Baptist. Because we see at the very beginning when he's talking about hearing, when John pointed out who Jesus was, it says Andrew and another disciple. Well, obviously that must have been John because he never mentions who it was. I'm sure he would have otherwise. And Jesus had enough confidence in him, which supports the idea of this cousin relationship, to ask him to look after his mother. Remember when Jesus was on the cross, he said to John, "This is your mother." He spent his last days as a very old man on Patmos, where he was exiled under the Emperor Domitian. And we don't know exactly when John was written. There's always argument over timings, but it was pretty late in the century. We can be pretty sure of that. He wrote 5 books that we have in the Bible, of course. This Gospel, 1, 2, and 3 John. And he's almost certainly the writer of Revelation. So why did he write it? Well, most of us know John said why he wrote it. He said, "These are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." And it's key that we understand that when we're looking at John, because that it does explain what he is writing about and how he writes it. Because one thing is, it doesn't fit very well with the other 3 Gospels. They're called synoptic Gospels because they all cover similar ground. They either copy each other or a common source. But John doesn't. So maybe he's written this knowing what the other Gospels were, and he wants to fill in bits and amplify areas and put in things that he thinks might have been missed in the others. He only has 3 healing miracles, none of which are in the other Gospels. There are only 4 miracles over nature, and 2 of those aren't in the other Gospels either. And he has 1 raising from the dead, which is Lazarus, which isn't in the other Gospels either. So you have him kind of filling in gaps, if you like. But like all the other Gospels, he does have the death of Jesus and the resurrection, although, of course, with a slightly different viewpoint. Now, when you look at a timeline, he doesn't really have one. John is very much, his focus is on what Jesus said and who he was, rather than what happened after one thing after another. So we shouldn't assume that when John puts one thing after another, that that is exactly what happened in the timeline. One good thing about studying John is that when you know the key words that he likes and the phrases he uses, then you can very easily think, when I'm looking for, now where does that verse come from? You think, oh yeah, it's probably John because of this. So he likes the word life 36 times in his gospel. Witness, testimony, it's the same word but translated differently sometimes, 14 times. Testify, the verb of the same word, 33 times. The word world, 78 times in one gospel. That's a lot. But he does use it with different meanings. And most of us, particularly I think long-term Christians, will understand a lot of these different meanings of the word world, universe, the earth, most people, or people or systems who are against God. Truth and light are very common themes that he uses. And he doesn't use the word miracles, he uses the word signs. Because John wants to demonstrate that these miracles are signs of who Jesus is. If we start at the beginning, chapter 1. So if you've got a Bible, we are going to kind of work our way through it. Hopefully not too heavily, or not too long either. But we have to start at the beginning, the section that's loved to be read at Christmas particularly, where it talks about Jesus being the Word. Now, the Word is very much related to Greek thought, because the Greeks saw a person's words as part of the personality. They were indistinguishable from the speaker themselves. The Word was the embodiment of the mind and will. So to call Jesus the Word of God was to say Jesus was God in every way. When he talks about in the beginning, he's giving Jewish thought, because of course he's talking about creation. In the beginning was God. Through him all things were made. God is the creator, the life giver. God created light. So when it says the Word was life and life was the light of men, again, you have this reference to creation. So he's saying Jesus was God. Now then, as we move on in this chapter, it starts with a lot of John the Baptist. Talks about what he was saying and what he was doing. And it reinforces the idea that John was a disciple of John the Baptist. And he talks about the testimony of John. We have John's disciples following Jesus, and Andrew goes and tells Simon, whom Jesus later calls Peter. And later on, Jesus calls more disciples, specifically Philip. And the interesting thing is, between verses 6 and 51, there are seven references to Jesus. Jesus is called different things. These are Lamb of God, verses 29-36. Jesus is the sacrifice. He's called Son of God, 34-49. That's fairly self-explanatory. He's called Rabbi in verses 38-49. He was a teacher. He's actually referred to as Messiah in verse 41. He is Jesus of Nazareth in verse 45. In other words, no confusion as to who this Jesus is. We're talking about the man, Jesus Christ. King of Israel in verse 49. And Son of Man in verse 51. Fully human as well as fully God. John is saying that the fully human Jesus of Nazareth is the messianic king, teacher of Israel, and the Son of God, who will die like the sacrificial lamb for the sins of the whole world. Now in John, there are lots of patterns in the way that he writes. We probably know that in a lot of the Old Testament, there were some very clever ways of writing, where you had beginnings and endings meeting in the middle and the number of verses and things. And John also has some of this. We've said there are seven descriptions of Jesus. There are also seven signs, seven miracles. We have water into wine, healing the official's son in Capernaum, healing the lame man at Bethesda Pool, feeding the 5,000, The man born blind, this is the story where he spits and puts the clay on the eyes. Raising Lazarus from the dead. And the large haul of fish, which happens after the resurrection. So we have the seven. Then we also have some very well-known verses. We have seven I am the statements. I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the gate. I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way, the truth and the life. I am the vine. There's also an emphasis on special feasts. He includes four feasts where Jesus appears. And he also covers four areas of Jewish life, like marriage with the wedding at Canaan and three others. I don't want to go into too much. It's too easy to get complicated, isn't it? There is a pattern as we read the rest of John which recurs again and again and again. Jesus performs a miracle or does some teaching or both, and people do not understand or they get angry and annoyed. So this occurs again and again as we go through. So let's get into the body of the book now. So we're going to start at chapter 2, verses 1 to 11, the wedding at Cana. Why would John include this story? Well, Isaiah 25:6 is something that people would think of, who were normal Jews, when he talked about the wonderful wine that was produced by Jesus' miracle. And it says, on this mountain the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. We have verse 12 to 3:36, Jesus' first recorded visit to Jerusalem and to Judea. And John puts the cleansing of the temple here when the other Gospels tend to put it at the end of his ministry when he goes to Jerusalem. We have his meeting with Nicodemus, and we have a referral again to John the Baptist, who again refers to Jesus as being the person who is God and that people should follow. John the Baptist describes Jesus as being from heaven and above all. In other words, the ultimate authority and the king. Okay, you ready? We're on chapter 4 now. Here we have Jesus with the woman in Samaria, the woman at the well. So John is writing here about Jesus being the water of life. He also covers the fact that he says, we don't worship in a place, but in spirit and in truth. An important teaching he's getting across, because of course the Jews felt that you worshipped in the temple. That's where God is. And certainly Greeks and Romans would also associate worship with a temple of some sort. So John is bring out that Jesus is saying you worship in spirit. And here he also makes a very clear declaration that he is the Messiah. Because the Samaritan woman says, are you the Messiah? And he says, I am he. We then have Jesus in Cana. He's moved up from Jerusalem through Samaria to the Galilee area where Cana is. And we have the healing of the royal official's son in Capernaum. Now, John here is recording a miracle where the person who is healed is not present. He is some distance away. And when you read the story, you'll notice at the beginning, John says about Jesus not being accepted in his own country. So we don't have any healings mentioned, no miracles mentioned in Galilee itself where he is, but the healing actually happens in Capernaum on the coast. That was about 12 miles away as the crow flies. Chapter 5. Jesus is in Jerusalem. John always places Jesus somewhere. And he's there for another feast. Because when there was a feast of the Jews, all the men would go to Jerusalem to celebrate it. So regularly in Israel, Jewish men would head for Jerusalem and pack it out. And here Jesus heals on the Sabbath. And which causes a bit of friction. And here we see this pattern of Jesus doing a sign, teaching on it, and then being misunderstood and even hated for it. He uses the miracle to talk about his relationship with the Father. Chapter 6, Jesus is in Galilee again. Large crowds. This is a packed chapter. That's probably why it's 70 verses. So we start with the feeding of the 5,000. Then we have Jesus walking across Galilee. We have teaching about the bread of life. Again, Jesus argues with the Jewish leadership. And here we have Jesus teaching the disciples, and it says at the end that many leave because they can't accept what he says about eating his body. This is not the 12 disciples, because we kind of get into this mindset, there's Jesus, there's 12 disciples, there's these bad guys, the Pharisees and Sadducees, and then there's ordinary people out there somewhere. But Jesus had a lot of disciples. Most of the time it wasn't just the 12 going around with him. They were here his inner circle. But there were a lot of people that still followed Jesus and followed him around as well. But a lot of them have trouble with what Jesus is saying at this point. They obviously take him literally when that was not what Jesus was quite saying. Whether he said it to kind of weed people out a bit, I don't know. But we're left with this wonderful declaration by Peter who says, where else can we go? You have the truth. You have life. It's probably worth mentioning that when I looked up about Sanhedrin, because I wanted to be certain what the Sanhedrin was, because it's mentioned quite regularly in John, I'd always thought there was one Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, but apparently each city had its own council, you know, its own Sanhedrin. So probably when we come across Jesus arguing with Pharisees, Sadducees, etc., they're not all in the same place. They're not all the same ones each time. So that's an interesting thought. Chapter 7. Jesus at the Feast of Tabernacles. John records that Jesus knows it's not safe for himself in Jerusalem. So he waits to leave the safety of Galilee. And then when he arrives, he stays quiet for a while, keeps his head down. But the same pattern arises. Jesus teaches, we get a mixed reaction. And Jesus avoids seizure and arrest because he's gone over a line and they want to arrest him. It is interesting that sometimes people think that as Christians we should never run away. We should stand our ground and trust God. But even Jesus ran away when things were dodgy. Because sometimes that's the right thing to do. Get out of there. And at the end of the chapter, we have the Pharisees arguing about Jesus. And Nicodemus kind of sticks his hand up and gets slapped down. Chapter 8. This is interesting. I'm not sure whether your version of the NIV in the pews says it, but it does. In mine, it says, these verses do not appear in the oldest and most reliable texts. Which is a shame, because this is a really good story, isn't it? It is so Jesus, this story. But the interesting thing is that in some manuscripts, this story appears in Luke. And my feeling is that maybe this was something that the early church knew about, but just none of the gospel writers had actually recorded it. And so later people said, this is too good a story, we've got to stick it in one of these gospels. And so they put it in there. That's my guess, anyway. Chapter 8 continued. Jesus argues with the Pharisees again in the temple area. He talks about the light of the world, the validity of his testimony, that God is his witness. He speaks fairly clearly of his death. And then we have the arguments over being children of Abraham. These people he was talking to, again, it says at the beginning of the chapter, they were disciples. They were people who were following him and believing in him. But obviously they still had this very strong Jewish idea that they are saved because they are Jews. They are children of Abraham. And Jesus is breaking this down. And it ends badly because Jesus actually uses the proper name of God and says, I am. That was going way too far. That was blasphemous, and they tried to stone him. Again, he runs away. Chapter 9. We have the man born blind, again, on the Sabbath. So that is a problem. And interestingly, the argument this time is the blind man arguing with the authorities, not Jesus. Whoops, that was too soon, wasn't it? And it's mentioned here that people who believed in Jesus would be excommunicated. If they knew that people were saying that Jesus was the Messiah, they were chucked out of the temple. And that is basically what we call excommunication. So again, we have the pattern of Jesus doing and saying something. Some accept him, some aren't sure. And others, particularly the authorities, reject him. Chapter 10. Jesus is out and about, and he's teaching on the Good Shepherd and the gate. And then we have Hanukkah, and the sheep theme is picked up again. Yeah. And he teaches again on this theme of the sheep. And again, the Jews, by which John is referring to the Jewish leadership, the religious leaders of the time, they try and stone him. Chapter 11. The whole chapter is about the raising of Lazarus. And again, key teaching points are raised here, particularly the declaration of Martha, where she says, if you'd been here, Lord, he wouldn't have died. And Jesus has a conversation with her. And she says, I believe in the resurrection. It's a very clear statement. But the raising of Lazarus is a big problem for the Sanhedrin. And this is where John specifically says, they plot to kill him. One thing that comes out from John when you look carefully is that he had insider information on what went on in the Sanhedrin. More than the other Gospels, he recounts what they're saying, what their decisions are, what's going on. So whether he had, his family had particular contacts that enabled them to know what's going on in there, or whether it's because he had friends in high places. Chapter 12. Jesus is in Bethany and Jerusalem for the Passover. We're starting on the journey to the cross. At verse 43, this pattern that has happened again and again, where we've been looking at Jesus teaching and causing trouble, being rejected, stops. We don't have that anymore. We have Mary washing Jesus' feet with perfume, up to verse 12, followed by the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And we have some Greeks asking to speak with Jesus. Again, the suggestion that Jesus is not just here for the Jews, he's here for the whole world. And Jesus again predicts his death in verses 20 to 36. Many people are believing in Jesus, but they're too afraid to admit it. John reflects on the unbelief of most people, and he quotes Jesus about the judgment of those who won't believe. Chapter 13. Here we have John washing the disciples' feet. Jesus. Yes, thank you, David. Jesus washing the disciples' feet. My brain was already jumping onto the bit about, we have this issue in this chapter that John talks about it was just before the Passover feast, which makes you think that it was days before the Passover feast. And yet what he records seems to be the night of the Last Supper. So that would suggest it was different to the other three Gospels. But it may be that he's saying just before the feast got underway, he washed the disciples' feet. We don't know. It's just one thing where John is very different to the other Gospels. So you can't be sure what's going on there. But because there's no chronology, how do you know? Jesus predicts his betrayal and Peter's denial. Jesus teaches. One chapter after another is just Jesus teaching. Whether all of this happened on the Passover night or not, can't be sure. That's how John's written it. But I don't think he cares too much about timing. He puts things that thematically fit together, things that suit the timing. So chapter 14 is all about the Father and the Holy Spirit. Chapter 15 is the vine, the hate of the world for those who follow Jesus. John puts this as Jesus having moved to Gethsemane. Gethsemane? Do I mean Gethsemane? I mean Mount of Olives. That's wrong. Mount of Olives. But whether, again, that's right or not, not sure. It doesn't change what Jesus said. And then we have another chapter 16 of teaching Jesus on the Holy Spirit and the fact that he's going to leave the disciples, and they ask him questions about it. Chapter 17 is Jesus praying. He prays for himself, he prays for the disciples, and he prays for us. He prays for all those who believe in him. We now move on to the arrest and crucifixion, chapters 18 and 19. We have the betrayal, arrest, and trials of Jesus. Jesus is taken to Annas's house, verses 1 to 14, where he's questioned, and we have Peter denying Jesus. And Jesus is then passed to Caiaphas. John puts some detail into the questioning by Annas, but he has nothing on Caiaphas. So it looks like he was able to get into the trial at Annas' place, but not into Caiaphas's. Then we have quite a bit on Jesus before Pilate in chapter 18, going into chapter 19. Chapter 19, there is a lot on the trial before Pilate, and it focuses very much on Jesus' kingship. That's something that John is keen to point out quite a bit, that Jesus is the ultimate king. And he also explains the notice being put above the cross that said, King of the Jews. So in this one chapter, we have the trial by Pilate, the crucifixion, and Jesus being buried. Chapter 20, the empty tomb, discovered by Peter, the disciple whom Jesus loved, and Mary Magdalene. We have Jesus appearing to Mary Magdalene, then to the disciples, and then showing himself to Thomas. The other Gospels don't have this meeting of Thomas with Jesus, but it's a really key one, because it's the only place that I'm aware of where somebody declares Jesus is God. He calls Jesus my Lord, and that word would only be used for God. Chapter 21. John calls the Galilee the Sea of Tiberias here. And we have Jesus' final miracle, where the disciples can't catch anything, and they see a man on the shore who tells them to throw their net over the other side, and there are too many fish for them to cope with. And they know it's Jesus. And here we have John recording Peter being restored. Jesus saying, "Do you love me? Feed my sheep." And interestingly, we have Jesus referring to John, because Peter said, "What about him? What about your really special guy?" And this is where the rumor about John never dying came about, which caused a bit of friction. But he actually did live longer than all the others, as far as we know. He lived to a good old age. So, the question we have to ask, was the fully human Jesus of Nazareth the messianic king and teacher of Israel, the Son of God who died like the sacrificial lamb for the sins of the world? That's what the Gospel of John is saying. He said, "This is the disciple who testifies." My words have disappeared completely off the edge. We know that his testimony is true, which may not have been written by John. That may have been put in by others who said, "We know this because this is John." So he knew what was going on. And John says, "Jesus did many other things as well." I think he might have said that because he said, "I've only written a little bit. I've written these things so that you know who Jesus was, but there's so much more. But I haven't included it here." So that's the Gospel of John. And so over to David to look after the next.